CP Portland Branch, and Jason Renault of the Mental Health Association of Portland. Again, that's the Mayoral Candidate Forum on Social Justice, Thursday, March 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Follow KBOO on Twitter and join in on conversations and up-to-the-minute updates on special programs. Just search for KBOO online or on your favorite Twitter app to find us. Learn about station news, find out about recommended events, and see what we're talking about, whether it be news, interviews, or music.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jan Martel, whose latest novel is The High Mountains of Portugal. Jan Martel is the author of Life of Pi, Beatrice, and Virgil. There are 5 books of fiction, 1 book of nonfiction, which is a very strange book, which I'm going to want to ask you about. But first, let's talk a little bit about, I guess, the themes that appear in your works, the nature of faith. And I guess that when you start from there, you see a strong pattern. Is that correct?
My first 2 books, so the collection of short stories and my first novel, have nothing to do with faith. They're anti-faith. The characters have very anti-religious feelings. I grew up very much in the secular mainstream where art replaced religion. And it's only in Life of Pi that I became interested in that phenomenon called faith.
Why?
Because, well, I'm going to generalize here, but being a male and being bright, I was encouraged to be reasonable. And then I was good at school, and school kind of encourages you to be reasonable. And then I studied philosophy at university, which encourages you to be reasonable. So by the time I got to my mid-30s or early 30s and I was traveling in India, I didn't realize this, but I guess I was starting to run on empty, that being reasonable in itself wasn't a satisfying experience. It had scoured away a lot of the wonder of life, which in some ways is very useful. It's useful to be critical, to scour away the nonsense and the reprehensive. But it was also starting to affect me as a writer, because I had become a writer, and a writer is an artisan of wonder. And by the time I got to India, I was realizing that this excess of reasonableness was affecting my contentment. And I happened to be in India, and I noticed for the first time religious manifestations, which are very common in India. India is an exuberantly religious place, for better and for worse. You see manifestations of religion everywhere, whether it's Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, Christianity, Jainism, Sikhism, you see it. And for the first time in my life, I started looking at religion, not seeking what I hated in it. The homophobia, the sexism, the paternalism, the narrowness. I started seeing quiet acts of faith that were not out to judge anyone, not out to hate anyone, but just were a quiet affirmation of a different reading of the universe. And I was suddenly struck by that, of how after, you know, hundreds of years of the triumph of modernity, the triumph of science, medicine, technology, all those stupendous acts of reason that had got, you know, us on the moon and us vaccinated and all that, how is it there were still people that believed in these funny little thing called gods? And rather than approaching that question with an ironic or a cynical perspective, I sort of said, after all, I'm a writer. Everything I write is based on the suspension of disbelief. These people in religion also operate on the idea that you have to have faith. And so I sort of saw that parallel between art and religion, and I just became interested. And that interest has been ongoing. Now, my previous novel, Beatrice and Virgil, was nothing particularly to do with religion. There's, I think, a brief mention of between the two main characters. But essentially, it's been in Life of Pi and the High Mountains of Portugal that I've been interested in looking at how faith operates, what it means, and in a purely sort of exploratory way.
The High Mountains of Portugal consists of 3 novellas that are related. The first, I guess, has elements of surrealism in it. The second is kind of a fantasy, and the third is more realist. yet they take place in the same area, and there are objects that go from one story to the other. When you began looking at it, where did you start for this particular book?
Well, literally, I started at the beginning and finished at the end. I write in a quite linear fashion. I started with research. I do a lot of research. So, you know, in this case, in part one, it features a road trip in a very early automobile. It takes place in 1904. So I did research on, you know, 1904 Renaults. I found a museum in the south of England that had a 1904 Renault. And so I looked at it from every angle. And I read up on animal behavior, on pathology, all kinds of things. And that gave me ideas. Those ideas led me to further avenues of research. And then I started writing. And each section, you call it three novellas. It's funny, I still call it a novel. But you're right, they're in three distinct sections. They're very linked, not only by a certain animal character, but also mainly a certain thematic, which is our relation to faith. And I say, you know, faith, and the reason I talk about religious faith is that I find it's the boldest of faiths. You know, faith in a loved one has a degree usually of some self-interest. You fall in love with a woman or a man, it is an act of faith, but you also, the reward is tangible, you know, in physical terms of comfort, in perhaps in terms of status, perhaps in terms of reproduction, of having descendants. Religious faith is the one that, there's obviously a reward in there, but the self-interest is not as obvious. The gratification of religion is a less tangible one than the gratification of physical love, of romantic love, or even of political love, loving a particular political system. So I chose religious faith because it's the boldest, the most imaginative leap of faith that the human species has managed. So each of the three sections has a different tinge to it in terms of faith. So in part one, Tomas is in rebellion. He has no faith. And so I'm sort of interested in exploring there how that manifests itself, what happens. In part two, the character has faith, but his faith is tested. It's very easy having faith when it's not tested. The real test of faith is when it is challenged, mainly by adversity. And in part three, I was sort of positing what would be the ideal state you'd want to be in if you were in a relationship with an object of faith. And I thought it'd be obvious to be with that object of faith. So, you know, the ideal relationship with Jesus would have been to be the few hundred people who actually met him in the year 0 to 30, you know, 32 or 33. His disciples, obviously, would have known him intensively, day in and day out. But even people who just met him briefly, you know, the leper who was cured by him, the woman whose hemorrhage was cured by him, what would that have been like? Well, we know what it was like. They were so struck that they talked about it every day of their lives subsequently, and these oral tales eventually, you know, got to the ears of Paul, who wrote letters, and eventually got to the ears of the evangelists who wrote these letters that changed the course of Western civilization. So in part three, I posit this sort of state of grace of someone living with his faith object, and it completely transforms his life.
Jan Martel, we can get into what the faith object is. Odo, a chimpanzee, which brings me back to my very first question. When you start, if you start at the beginning and go to the end, you still know at that point that you're going to be searching for information about chimpanzees, or you're going to be searching for information about, in part two, autopsies in 1939 and Agatha Christie.
Yeah. No, you're right. Sorry, I should have explained that. Before I write a word, I've already in my mind figured out a lot of things.
Yeah.
So in this one, all my stuff actually, before I write a word, because to me it's such a, you know, writing a novel, I don't want to sound pompous here, but writing a novel is kind of like building a cathedral or a really tall skyscraper. It's a lot of work in the head, at least for me. I'm not as natural a writer as, you know, Joyce Carol Oates or these people who write in entire chapters. It's a labor for me. So if I'm going to do that, I'm going to very carefully plan it out. I'm going to very carefully do my architectural plan before I start doing the foundation. So you're right. I've thought it all through. So right from the start, I had this chimpanzee in different guises. In part one, he's sort of a reified chimpanzee. He's just a sculpture. In part two, he's imaginary in a sense. He's magical, so he's only accessed if you can do that magical thinking. And then in part three, he's quite concrete. He's the real thing. He's literally a real chimpanzee. So yes, right, once I decided that, and in my mind weighed the pros and the cons of various things, then I was directed in my research. And so you're right, by the time I started the first word of the novel, I pretty well knew where I was going exactly as to how it would end. And same thing with Life of Pi. When I wrote the author's note, I knew exactly what chapter 100 would contain. I didn't know the exact wording, but I knew pretty well what it was going to say.
In your research then, did you find anything about chimpanzees that either was a surprise that you could put in the book or something that made you think, I don't know about this idea.
Well, it is a fictionalized treatment of a chimpanzee. So, in fact, chimpanzees are in some ways very similar to us, and mainly in their extraordinary ability to be aggressive. You know, lions are actually relatively peaceable animals. They kill, but only to eat, and they otherwise are just sit around and, you know, they're like people on, you know, couch potatoes, drinking beer, watching TV. They're not particularly active animals. Chimpanzees have a capacity to be extraordinarily violent. They're the only animal that we consider to sort of commit murder in the sense that they kill unnecessarily. So stray chimpanzees that roam into the territory of a foreign troop of chimpanzees will sometimes be hunted down and killed without there being any necessity for it, which is unusual in the animal world, because in the animal world, in a sense, like with us, when two belligerent males encounter each other, they usually have many signals. They signal their belligerence in many ways to sort of not get to the real down-and-out killing fight. You know, men will shout, will throw their chests out, will shove a bit, but they won't normally immediately pull out the gun that, here we are in America, they'll pull out and shoot each other. They'll usually signal. And same thing with animals. They will usually signal their aggression so they don't get to the final fight, because if they do, it's to the death. Chimpanzees don't seem to have as many limits, and so they can be extraordinarily violent. So in this one I chose, and it's signaled early in that section, that Odo is very much an omega male, a very subservient by chimpanzee standards, because I didn't want the kind of horrifically violent chimpanzees that can be out there. So in that sense it's fictionalized. And you asked if there are surprises. Well, yes, because it is intriguing how the greater apes have more of an intellectual life than other animals do. And it is odd how they do reflect in our ways. They do have the rudiments of civilization and of culture. You know, they were used, this is quite well known, they were used for sign language experiments. So they do have a capacity for language. But essentially, honestly, this is not a work of animal behavior. This is a novel in which I use a chimpanzee mainly as a vehicle to make a point. And I chose a chimpanzee because Darwin brought chimpanzees very close to us suddenly. After centuries of animals being pushed away from us, suddenly Darwin in the mid-19th century said, you know what, animals are actually a lot closer to us than you think. He didn't know that, but we know now that they share over 97% of our genetic material. I wanted a smoky mirror to who we are, something that would plausibly be human, yet not quite human, so that if I put it on a cross, and here we'll reveal that it wasn't farcical, but slightly disturbing.
Jan Martell, what I noticed about Odo and his relationship with Peter is that no matter how much he's an individual and quote-unquote a person, there's always a sense of danger, because you never know what's happening. And I guess that ties in with faith.
Absolutely. There is an element of mystery to animals, which I think is part of their appeal. And as you're right, is inherently, it's interesting when you read about religion. Don't forget, I come from the mainstream. When you're from the mainstream, you know nothing about religion. You have assumptions that are then corrected when you learn more. And one thing that was always interesting that when I read the Old Testament and the New Testament is, yes, that element of fear, awe. It's more not fear, but awe. Because we tend to assume that God is some sort of lovey-dovey fear. And that element of awe is sort of surprising. And of course, it would be necessary. Something that would be some greater plan would be awe-inspiring. And once again, I find it echoed in animals, that they do contain an element of mystery because they are beyond our understanding. Humans, even of a different culture who don't speak a language, we can somehow read ourselves better. We are less mysterious to ourselves than animals are to ourselves. And so that, in a sense, echoes nicely the idea of why I use animals. And it is because, in some ways, our relationship to animals echoes our relationship to the divine. There are qualities that both of those share. So one thing that is striking when you look at religious figures is their capacity to be in the present moment, to be right here, right now. You read that about Jesus, about Buddha, about Krishna. There's a sense that when they're with whoever they're with, they're fully there. And that's a striking feat. Well, that's also an animal-like quality. Animals are also very good at being in the present moment. They're also very limited in their capacity to delve into the past or worry about the future.
And they're also, on some level, ineffable. I mean, we've all had dogs and cats.
Absolutely. And that's domesticated ones, which are quite infantilized. They're absolutely ineffable. So there is that mystery, both in animals and in the divinity. There's that sense of presence in the animal and the divine. And we're the ones in the middle. who have great difficulty being in the present moment. We're always distracted by thoughts of the past or by worries about the future. We are not ineffable. We're supremely, what's the opposite of ineffable? We're supremely fubble. So that's why I find the divine and the animal echo each other very nicely, which is why in these novels about religion, I use so many animals, because I find it lends itself to the theme.
You're listening to an interview with Jan Martel, whose latest book is titled The High Mountains of Portugal. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Jan Martel, in the second section of The High Mountains of Portugal, you have a curious notion that I'd never thought of, which is the relationship of Agatha Christie mysteries to the Gospels. And apparently you read all her books between 1920 and 1939. So let me ask you, did you start with this understanding? Or was it something that hit in your head, and was it just reinforced by the books?
No, I never thought of it before. It was sort of an insight I had. And to be honest, I should remember this, but I cannot remember why I thought of it particularly. I mean, I was already thinking about the Gospels, because after all, the novel is broadly an allegory on the life of Jesus, set in secular terms. But I had this insight, and I read all of her books, except for the ones written under other names, like all the ones that she wrote as murder mysteries. I read, and indeed, I saw this surprising connection between the Gospels and her murder mysteries. You know what it first struck me about Agatha Christie is that she is by far the world's most popular writer. In the history of literature, in any language, she has sold more than anyone else. And it always struck me. Why? Because she's very English, and there's a particular appeal to murder mysteries. It is a genre piece. So why would that be? You know, why is it not some great work of literature that is the woman? No, it's Agatha Christie. And I finally, my insight was that because it does operate in many of the same ways as the Gospels, and just as the story of Jesus changed the course of Western civilization, and therefore was a best-selling story at that time, I think it's because they operate in the same way, and they make us think about death in ways that are palatable. Because we're afraid of death. We, of course, are afraid of death literally, but even talking about death, we try to distance ourselves as much as possible. So we can tolerate news stories about death and war, but only so much. But we know, any wise person knows, that at one point you have to think about it. And Agatha Christie managed to make you think about it, but in an entertaining way. But it's still thinking about it. You know, murder mysteries are set in a moral structure. Even the most odious person who was murdered, so for example on Murder on the Orient Express or Appointment with Death, the victims there are not nice people. Nonetheless, you have to find who did it and why. There's still a quest for meaning, for placing death in a framework that is meaningful. Well, the Jesus event 2,000 years ago did the same thing. Jesus talked about death in a way that was palatable. Why? Because he resurrects. In a sense, death, which until then was perceived as a finality for humans, suddenly is no longer a finality. And that was such a startling resolution to death, such a startling resolution to a murder, that it changed the course of Western civilization. And there's also a lot of narrative similarities. I mean, just a very, I don't want to summarize the whole section here, but, you know, for example, the role of the witness. In a murder mystery, witnesses are key. Hercule Poirot arrives, or Jane Marple arrives on the scene, and there's a body there, and he or she starts looking around, talking to people, talking to different witnesses. Well, the murder of Jesus, also the witness is key. And just as witnesses are unreliable in the Gospels, there's only four canonical Gospels. There's more than that, but there are four of them, and they don't say the same thing. Each varies slightly. Each is inconsistent. Sometimes is contradictory with other ones. So one reality, four reports of it. Same thing within Murder Mysteries of Agatha Christie. Witnesses are unreliable. They don't say the same thing. And there's all kinds of other similarities that struck me. And don't forget, in the novel, there's a purpose. It's not just, it's an interesting idea in itself, but in that section, there's a doctor who's working late at night, and it's a wife who knocks on the door late at night and says, listen, I have a solution. He wasn't aware there was a problem. And so she's making this linkage for a reason. It's connected to something, a greater purpose. If they put a murder mystery on top of the Gospel, they would see that there's a lot of narrative similarities, and it's quite surprising.
Jan Martel, when you go back and you look at these books, do you fully understand what you've written?
No. In the sense, I'm aware of my intent, but that's only the starting point. That's like a sprinter who's, you know, but the start of a 100-meter sprint. His intent is to cross a 100-meter line faster than anyone else. What that impact might be on other people, how they might feel about it, is something else. So same thing with all my books. I have a certain intent, but I've come to realize, and it's an obvious thing, that author intent is very quickly taken over by reader reception. How people take a book may coincide with how you feel about it as a writer, but may be taken in a whole new direction. And I especially saw that, of course, with Life of Pi. People brought insights that completely surprised me, but I saw fit very nicely. Because after all, a book is 50%. The other 50% is what readers bring to it. And that's where the book really becomes something. So no, in some ways, I'm not sort of clueless. I have a clue. But it goes in directions that surprise me and are deeply gratifying.
Well, there's also the possibility that of that 50% that is you, not all of it is conscious, too.
Oh, absolutely. You're totally right. In fact, the reasons why I write the books that I write, you know, I could say, well, I had this idea in mind, but why I had that particular idea comes from sort of some unconscious part of me that, in fact, I don't question to some extent. As much as I plan, underpinning it, of course, is a degree of spontaneity. I just write because that's what feels right to write.
The high mountains of Portugal is an actual place, but there are no high mountains in Portugal. Why did you choose that location?
Because in the northeast of the country, where I set this novel, it is a region called Trás-os Montes. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, Trás-os Montes, which means, in Portuguese, beyond or behind the mountains. And there are no mountains. There's at most hills, and not even particularly stark hills. They sort of, it generally rises up, and then you have kind of a slightly mountainous plateau. When I first visited the country when I was 1920, it's the first country I traveled in on my own, it struck me, and I realized how geography, our naming of things, toponymy, is an imaginary feat, is a kind of storytelling feat. We name places to make them more familiar to us, less daunting, less strange, less mysterious. And I was very struck that they'd call a place beyond the mountains when, first of all, there are no mountains to start with, and then your preoccupation isn't even the illusory mountains, but what's behind them. And so that always stayed with me. And so the high mountains in this novel, and two of the characters point out that they themselves are surprised that there are no mountains, is because these are sort of, in my mind, this is my intent, we'll see how readers receive it, in my mind, these are imaginary mountains. They're magical mountains. They're mountains in the mind that you climb or fail to climb in your heart, in your mind. So part one in Tomás, his quest is essentially negative. He seeks to conquer these mountains. Whereas in part three, Peter Tovey and his chimpanzee Odo are, in a sense, sitting on a mountaintop meditating like Buddhist monks. They're in a sort of state of grace on top of this mountain. These are imaginary mountains. They're magic mountains.
Life of Pi became a very successful film by Ang Lee. Did you have anything to do with the film at all? Or?
I was involved only very early on. I read two early drafts of the screenplay, and I have a small cameo. I'm on a little opposite a pond on a bench, and on the side of the pond, closer to the camera, there's a grown adult Pi and the author. But other than that, no, it's Ang Lee's movie, and it's their production. I took a back seat. In front, I wasn't asked to be in the front seat to start with, but also, I'm a writer. I'm happy. You know, my tool is the written word. I was happy to leave Ang Lee in the studio, try to translate that to the screen.
How did you feel about it?
I thought it was visually ravishing. People who've read the book, I think it's a nice compliment. I think the storytelling didn't quite capture everything in the book, but that's often quite common. It's, you know, it is a, I don't know how long Life of Pi is, but some 300 and some pages. You know, that's a lot of rumination, and it's hard to capture that in a movie. But generally, I was very happy. I believe in art. I believe in the risks of art. So even if it had been a dreadful movie, I wouldn't have regretted it. I believe in the risks that artists take, whether it's a poet doing a little, you know, haiku on a napkin or a massive Hollywood production. You can be as cynical as you want about Hollywood. What I've noticed, my personal experience of Hollywood, is to get the gates to open is nearly impossible. Once they're open, everything flows, and then it is creativity that's fully addressed. Then it's no longer about money. And in fact, it's an extraordinarily wasteful process, the way movies are made. The extra footage done in making movies means that you can actually make several movies out of one long shoot. But after that, once the green light is given, it's all about the creativity. And there are, in Hollywood, there are extraordinarily creative people. And in fact, to bring it all together, you know, writing a book is, you know, it's just you. It's just you sitting in your little garret working. Do a Hollywood production, these big, I mean, at the height of production in Taiwan, there are over 500 people working. And then that's not even counting the people in Hollywood and then the people in New York where Ang Lee is from, and that's not counting all the computer people who are generating the computer-generated imagery. To bring all that together in one seamless whole is a daunting endeavor.
Jan Martel, Life of Pi changed things because suddenly you were a commercially successful author.
If it hadn't succeeded, this bizarre tale of, you know, mixing zoology and theology, I would have been someone with the most pathetic CV. The last job I held down was as a security guard, and that was, you know, 15 years earlier. And before that, I was a tree planter and a dishwasher. I'd have been a 30-year-old guy with on his CV, you know, under hobbies, three books written. And I know loads of writers who've given everything to the muse, to their art, and receive very little back in terms of material reward, and that's hard. But, you know, you have to tell the story that you need to feel have to tell, and I took that risk. So it made me materially more comfortable. But as a writer, it changes nothing. If you're successful commercially, it doesn't improve you as a writer. I have the same strengths and the same weaknesses. I wrestle with the same things each time I write a new book. And when you write a new book, you do close the door on the world and all the noise about Life of Pi, and the new project, whether it be Beatrice and Virgil or this one, is a whole new endeavor.
The nonfiction book, which is Letters to Stephen Harper. I haven't seen the book. I was trying to get a handle on what exactly you were doing there.
Well, for 4 years in Canada, I'm Canadian, for 4 years, Stephen Harper was the Prime Minister of Canada for about 10 years, and he was one of these dismal, stupid white males who dominate our lives. And he's one of these men, I think, who in their early 20s stops reading fiction because he figures it's not real and therefore its truth must be relative, and doesn't read for 40 years. And only then, once he's been pushed into retirement, does he perhaps start reading again and rediscover what fiction can do. And so Stephen Harper is a middle-aged white man who doesn't read. And is that a problem for me? In terms of him being a human being, no. But in terms of being Prime Minister of my country, yes, because he has power over me. And therefore, whether he reads or not does matter to me, because what one reads kind of says something about the quality of their dreams. And it's important to me what the dreams of my politicians are, because their dreams can become my nightmares. So if I find out that a politician only reads Ayn Rand, it makes me think, okay, I'm a little bit suspicious of that. If a politician only reads, you know, well, I don't want to slander something, but some very popular writer, then, you know, I want to get a sense of the temper of their mind. And the temper of the mind will, to some extent, be determined by reading. And I also don't know how someone can know the human condition if they haven't done one of two things, either read books or traveled. Traveling is a way to unsettle you. If I took you and plunked you in the middle of Pakistan or the middle of Papua New Guinea or in Africa, it would shake you. It would change you. And the same thing with a book. A book is another form of traveling. It increases your empathy, because a good book will make you live the life of those characters, and you therefore get a bit of their wisdom. You know, art generally, if you're disposed towards it, if you open yourself to it, if you read it in good faith, does lead to your betterment. And so someone who does not read, it scares me. So what I did for 4 years is I sent him a book every 2 weeks. Short books, because the usual claim, the usual excuse that people who don't read gives, that they're too busy. So they're usually books under 200 pages of all genres, novels, poetry, plays, very little nonfiction, graphic novels, children's stories, all cultures, Quebecois, Canadian, American, African, all European, all times, you know, from the Bhagavad Gita. I send him a Harlequin romance, Agatha Christie, I send him Pearl Buck. And each one I wrote a letter explaining why it would be worth reading it.
And was there any response whatsoever?
Zilch. I got 7 letters from his correspondence staff, but those are sort of form letters. You know, dear Mr. Martel, thank you for sending the Prime Minister. Be assured that he's touched, yours truly. But from the man himself, nothing. And, you know, I'm quite a well-known writer in Canada. You know, Life of Pi, Booker Prize, Hollywood movie, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That I didn't get a single response from the man himself. It's not like my letters were threatening. They were certainly ironic, but nothing compared to the rough treatment that you get in politics. And he could have replied in an equally ironic arch letter. He could have said, you know, after 5 letters of mine, he could have said, dear Mr. Martel, yes, I do read. In fact, I love this, that author, and that. He could have been lying through his teeth. It would have shut me up. And these letters, this big fat book, is 101 letters I wrote to the man. By 6 degrees of separation, we know that he got the books. We know that he looked at them. We know that his staff even prepared a brief summary of the first books. It was mentioned in the House of Commons. No, it had a lot of media repercussions, echoes in the media, and no, nothing.
Jan Martel, now High Mountains of Portugal is out. Have you begun work on another book?
No, I work slowly and for a long time on my books, so I have nothing in mind whatsoever. I have 4 young children, 6, 4, 2, and 9 months old. And to me, they're like little Russian novels. Meandering plot, great setting. So I'm attending to those 4 novels.
You've been listening to an interview with Jan Martel, whose latest novel is The High Mountains of Portugal. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also find an extended version of this interview. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are not alone. Strike Debt Portland, in solidarity with the National Strike Debt Movement, will hold a debtors' assembly at 6805 North Macrum Street in St. John's on Saturday, March 12th, 3:30 to 5:30. Again, this Strike Debt Assembly is on Saturday, March 12th at 3:30 at 6805 North Macrum Street in St. John's, just off Willamette Boulevard. For more information, go to 350pdx.org.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Salt of the Earth. Based on actual events, this film depicts a strike by Mexican-American mine workers in New Mexico. Against a backdrop of social injustice, a family drama is played out by a miner and his wife. Again, that's Salt of the Earth, Thursday, March 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And welcome to Words and Pictures, your comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're bringing you a special presentation, a conversation between two celebrated graphic novelists, Eisner Award-winning author Craig Thompson, whose works include Blankets and Habibi, and Jean Luen Yang, who currently serves as the Library of Congress's National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. In 2013, Craig and Jean shared the stage at Portland's Wordstock Literary Festival and asked each other about their creative processes and the themes that run through their stories. So, from October 5th, 2013, here is Craig Thompson and Jean Luen Yang in conversation.